there should be a space in the world to understand that obesity, carrying too much fat, is a problem. But also not blame the person suffering from the condition. People with obesity are not bad. They're fighting biology.
Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age, from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
Hello and welcome to this episode of The Curious Advantage podcast. My name is Paul Ashcroft. I'm one of the co-authors of the book, The Curious Advantage. And today I'm here with my co-authors, Simon Brown.
Hello.
And Garrick Jones.
Hi there.
And today we are delighted to be joined by Dr. Giles Yeo. Hi, Giles.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you're very, very welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast. And just a bit of a plug straight away, and I was enjoying this recently over the holidays, but reading Giles's book, While Calories Don't Count, is a brilliant read. And I'm going to encourage everyone to read it, but we're going to find out all about it and about Giles through this podcast. Let's get straight into it. Giles, you wear a lot of hats. You're a geneticist, research leader, author, science communicator. Could you tell us a bit about your journey into the world of genetics and how did it all begin for you?
I did, by chance, I think all of it, as these things are. I always knew I wanted to be some kind of biologist. I was good at biology, so I ended up doing just a standard molecular biology degree at UC Berkeley in California, which is where I'm from. But I specialized in genetics in the last 2 years. I had done a practical on fruit flies, you know, just Drosophila things. And you know, it was a standard kind of thing. You had to sex the flies. You had to cross them to see why some had red eyes and some. But actually, it was the first time I had direct input into genetics, so to speak, you know, practical input. And so I really loved it. And so I specialized in genetics and then ended up doing a PhD in Cambridge on molecular genetics of Japanese pufferfish. So I don't know if you guys are into expensive sashimi. I never actually eaten it because even though I eat pretty much anything that relies on whether or not the chef was well enough trained to not kill me seems a little bit stepping over the...
I was going to say it's a high-risk endeavor to eat that.
It's a neurotoxin as well.
I was in Japan and staying in a ryokan, and it was a place where you had to have breakfast and lunch and supper. And it was served in your room by lovely people, and it was all amazing. And after day three, I said to them, I think I'm going to go out into Kyoto and have a meal. They said, oh, but Mr. Jones, we've already been to the market, and we've got a guy in, and he's doing fugu for you tonight. And I was like, well, thank you very much. I then looked up online what fugu was, and they said it was the most highly toxic thing on the planet, and it's been known to kill restaurant loads of people. So I survived, though. Thankfully, they haven't changed chef. But so this was your area of speciality, was it?
The genetics of it, this is pre-genome project. And we were using the pufferfish sort of as a model. It's without boring anyone silly, they got a very small genome. Okay, so 1/10 the size of humans. So 1/10 the amount of DNA as humans do. And we're both vertebrates. A fish is a vertebrate, humans are vertebrates. And so therefore, we actually have the same number of genes. And so if you have the same number of genes, but the genome is 10 times smaller, then what you can do is do compare and contrast to find the really important bits of it. So that's what I ended up doing for my PhD. And I'm well-trained as a molecular geneticist, but I think the fugu thing ended up being, or at least I felt that it was a bit too niche to pay my mortgage. And so I then used my molecular genetics skills, which I then picked up my PhD, and then I moved into the genetics of severe childhood obesity. And from then on, into body weight in general. And that's the genetic story and why I ended up doing body weight.
I saw at the top of our script today that the title for this is Curious About Genetics, the Brain, and the Science of Eating. But I really think it's basically curious about weight loss.
For most people, yes. I think for most people, I'm interested in body weight in general. Most people are not interested in why they're fat. They're interested in how they can become unfat. So yes, I think I probably agree with you.
So you've described your work as exploring how the brain influences our eating behaviors. How does the brain influence our eating behaviors, Giles?
I mean, that's how long a piece of string is. I think, you know, first of all, what's an eating behavior? So I think people think about eating, they think, well, I'm hungry or I'm full. Yes, those are probably behaviors. I think a good example, which I've used previously, is the Monday morning meeting scenario. we've all been there. It's Monday morning and we all sat around a table and someone has brought a plate of cookies. And I would argue that in this meeting room that we're in and the cookies have arrived, that there are at least four different feeding behaviors, okay? And so the first one is before the plate even stops sliding down the table, someone, me, would have already picked up a cookie and started munching on it. So that's behavior number one. Behavior number two are the people who long for the cookie. They desire the cookie. They want the cookie. But some internal algorithm stops them from having the cookie. But they obsess over the cookie the entire meeting and ignore the rest of the meeting. Behavior number two. Behavior number three are the people who eat the cookie without even knowing they have a cookie in their hand. They'll go munch, 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 munch. How's the cookie, Joe? And they go, what cookie? And then there's the fourth, and that's the most annoying person. And these are the people who are not even tempted by the cookie. The cookie kind of comes by, and they're not even looking at the cookie. And slightly facetious, I know, but actually, if you consider those four different behaviors, we all know where we sort of sit. You know, sometimes we overlap, and we know where our wives, our partners, our family members, where they would sit as well. That is feeding behavior. It's not only how hungry you feel, it's the general drive to pick up the cookie or not pick up the cookie and put it or not put it into your mouth. That is what I mean by feeding behavior. And our brain plays a very big role in pulling the strings about how we actually end up eventually picking up the cookie and munching on it.
And is that a fixed behavior? So if I probably in that category would be in the reaching and trying a cookie, and then once you've had one, then it's like, oh, they tasted really good, I might have to have a second and a third. Is that then a fixed behavior that sticks with me, or is this something that I can influence and change over time, how fixed is it, I guess?
It's a difficult question to answer. I think what you're asking is what the genetic versus the environmental contribution to such eating behavior is. And
you make it sound a lot better than how I asked it.
I mean, there is a number, actually. Now, I don't know if this is true for, if we parse every single behavior, is this necessarily true for every single act? One really doesn't know because we don't know it to this level of granularity. But if we ask the question about, well, what is the heritability, I guess it's the term we're going to call it, the heritability of body weight, and we know that genetics of body weight is the genetics of eating, so heritability of body weight. If you actually look at twin studies, so the study of twins, either identical twins who are genetic clones or non-identical twins who have 50% of genetic material, and you study tens of thousands of twin pairs, then you can actually ask the question about any trait. What happens when you share 100% of genetics versus 50% and you work out heritability? And if you do that for feeding behavior, then it turns out to be around 40 to 70%, there's a very big range. But if we take the average of that, then it tends to be 50-50. Nature versus nurture, or nature and nurture, shall we say. It's roughly 50-50. It's slightly more complex than that, but broadly speaking, that is what it is, 50-50.
So if half of me genetically is saying I should eat the cookie, then the remaining half is I can then influence through my willpower, through my environment, through those other pieces.
You see, willpower is an interesting word. I mean, what is willpower? I mean, if willpower is your ability to stop eating after one cookie, then I'd argue is part of the feeding behavior. Let me answer the question in another way in terms of learnt versus genetics. So, for example, look, if anyone can tell, I'm Chinese by ethnicity, so East Asian. My wife's a white Caucasian. Now, we both love carbohydrates. Now, without backing myself into a stereotype, my favorite type of carbohydrate is rice. It just has to be rice. I eat it all the time. You know, this is just what we will. My wife's favorite carbohydrate is bread or pastry or anything flour-based. So that is a situation where it's taught. Okay, the reason why I like rice, it's culturally ingrained in me. The reason why my wife likes bread and pasta, whereas I can neither take nor leave bread or pasta, that is ingrained and culturally ingrained. The love of carbohydrates, however, that is something which is genetic. This is what I mean by saying that it's very difficult to parse it specifically, but something like having a sweet tooth versus a savory tooth or a fatty tooth. You don't have a fatty tooth, but you know what I mean. That is likely to be heavily genetics influenced and less taught, whereas the type of sweet or carbohydrate or body part you eat, whatever it is, that tends to be culturally ingrained and that tends to be taught.
I'm wondering whether I'm a one or a three. Do I eat the cookie immediately, or do I eat and not even be aware that that is going on? You make me think about my DNA. From a genetics perspective, how do we understand the role of DNA in shaping our response to that, the eating of the cookie?
Mm. We know some pathways, the circuits, better than others. So your brain needs to know two internal pieces of information rather than the pieces of information from around the world. Okay, so internal pieces of information in order to influence our feeding behavior. And the first piece of information it needs to have is how much fat you have. And that's because fat is your long-term energy stores. And so that's how long you would last without food. And so your brain needs to know how much fat you're carrying. So that's the first piece of information. The second piece of information, your brain needs to know what you have just eaten and what you are currently eating. Okay. And these are going to be your short-term energy signals. And this is going to come from your gut, your stomach, your gastrointestinal tract. And so these are all hormonal. These long and short-term signals from the gut and from fat are all hormones. So they circulate in the blood. Your brain picks up on these long and short-term signals and then essentially then integrates them and influences your next interaction with the cookie, with the refrigerator, or with a menu. So some of the genes, for example, that we know about, and we know of over 1,000 genes that play a role in this feeding behavior abacus, whatever you want to call it, some of them make your brain feel less sensitive to the circulating hormones. So, for example, if I were carrying 20 kilos of fat, which is then roughly what I'm carrying at the moment, but your brain is only sensing 18 kilos of fat because it's slightly less sensitive, then it's going 18, I thought I had 20. And so it will then drive you to eat more to sort of make up the rest, but you already have 20 kilos. Imagine if you've had 1,000 calories for lunch, just as an example, even though they don't count, but your brain only senses 800 calories. You get where I'm going with this. So these are some of the pathways. Other genes might influence your ability to ignore yellow M's on the side of the motorway, just as an example, whereas other people are more drawn to that. So that is where these probably sit. There's going to be more subtle, more nuanced ways that we actually end up affecting our feeding behavior. But generally speaking, that is what we're beginning to understand. It's a wired network of these more than 1,000 genes. And these are not mutually exclusive. Clearly, you can have some or all or none of these different behaviors. But ultimately, they make you more or less likely to say no to the cookie.
So, Giles, does the brain then in some way get confused as to whether you're hungry or you're just craving something, or actually you want more food? So I get to the end of my meal and I have my dessert, my pudding, or whatever we want to call it. I might choose a healthy one, but I might just choose something unhealthy because actually I always do, right? I was full, but now I was quite happy to eat the extra ice cream. So how does the brain, you know, can we confuse our brain in this way? Does it get confused? What happens there?
So what we're talking about is appetite for food, right? So appetite is an interesting term, I think, because it's an integrative word. So it integrates at least three different concepts. It integrates how hungry you are, and we understand what that feels like, how full you are, which is a completely different set of circuits to how hungry you are, I want to point out, and a different part of the brain, and how nice you feel when you're eating. Okay, because for most of us, eating feels nice. Some feel more nice than others. Imagine that triangle of those three different concepts with appetite sat in the middle. Now, you can tug at any of the three points of the triangle and it changes the shape of the triangle, but the area still roughly remains the same, right? So in other words, your appetite is influenced by all three points. So now we get to the dessert stomach, okay, that you were actually bringing up. So for example, your appetite is here. The hungrier you are, the more likely okay, if you're really, really, really hungry, you know that the simplest foods taste the nicest. So you can just a bit of rice, a bit of bread, a bit of cheese. Mm. But the fuller you become, the more picky you become with your food. There's a far bigger hurdle to jump over to make it worth the while to actually reach down and actually eat the food. So therefore, the fuller you become, you need foods that wallop a great big hit on the nice bit of the brain. And this tends to be foods that are high in sugar and fat, because why would it not? And so actually, your dessert stomach is a physical manifestation, so to speak, of this triangle, where you're tugging the ends. And so the fuller you are, the higher the hurdle you need to jump over to make eating feel just as nice. And so we turn to high fat, high sugar, high caloric dense foods when it comes to desserts, because we tend to be full of protein or fish or whatever it is we're eating already.
So I remember someone telling me in the past, and I don't know if this is true, but good to know, that it takes sort of 20 minutes for your stomach to register that you've eaten something. So in that situation, if you're eating, it's 20 minutes after you've eaten it that you realize I was actually full 20 minutes ago and I shouldn't have eaten that dessert or whatever. Is there truth in that? That there's this sort of lag between your sense of eating and actually your brain saying, I'm full, you should stop eating now?
Yeah, there is truth to that. I mean, it clearly depends what you're eating. Sugary drinks, you don't have to wait 20 minutes. It goes right through and it gets absorbed. Whereas something complex and starchy or proteiny is probably going to take the full 20 minutes before it actually emerges out the other side. You know, just enough time for you to finish your sort of main meal before you do things. But no, it is absolutely right. It does. There is a physics that your food needs to get past a certain level before the relevant gut hormones are then released as your food sort of moves down the tube. Now, there are learned things, obviously, because most things we have eaten before. And so we register the fact that I'm going to have a bowl of strawberries and ice cream, just as an example. And already, if you like strawberries and ice cream, then salivation has begun. So you do learn of that. But yes, there is definitely a delay. And so the old wives' tale, for lack of a better term, that says, you should choose more slowly or you could do things, that's where it emerges from. Because typically if you end before you decide if you're at a buffet or something that you're going to go back for a second one, if you sit there for 15 minutes and if you need more food, by all means. But typically if you sit there for 15 minutes, you probably say, you know what, I'm okay now. So no, it's a real thing.
So we should slow down when we eat. I guess that's a precursor to my real question about this is amazing. It's fascinating that the weight is a relationship between my genes, my DNA, and the hormones, and then how those are influencing what my brain is telling me and then my behaviors. But what does this mean for us, for those of us who are wanting to lose weight or are constantly losing weight or are trying to remain slim? What are the implications for all of this for how we should control our behavior?
I had its implications on any number of different levels. Let's start with the smallest unit, so our homes, broadly speaking. And I think there is where we have the most control. You at least know what you're buying in to bring into the house. And so that's pretty much one of the only places you have where you can say, okay, now you can sit now and then you sort of reflect, right? Assuming you're honest with yourself, well, where do I sit in that feeding behavior, that cookie scenario? And then there's another one, right? Do I eat when I'm stressed? Do I not eat when I'm stressed? Once again, another split. And then you can then make some decisions about what you might or might not have in the house. The problem with that is that we do eat at home, but we have to then interact with the world to bring the food into the house, like in the supermarket, like everywhere else. And there is where I think the big weakness of pushing purely personal responsibility comes in. Because if you have some internal drive or socioeconomic drive, because remember, it's not only the internal drive, it's what you can afford, what choices you can or cannot make, right, as a human being. And then you step into the supermarket. Suddenly, there you're stepping into a place where people's jobs who are inventing the foods is to attract you to buy me, like in Alice in Wonderland, right? And so you then begin to interact with the world of marketing, the world of the food manufacturers, the world of policy. Where do they put chocolate? Do they put it by the tills? So you can control your household to a degree, but the implication is if you are susceptible for any number of different reasons to eating, but we don't as a society fix the food environment or the built environment, then it's very difficult to try and keep the weight off because you have to interact with the world in order to carry out your day-to-day living.
And what would fixing that food environment look like?
I think the difficulty with fixing the food environment is there is no one single answer. Public health is an interesting thing to my mind, okay? Because there is always a tension in public health between what liberties are you willing to lose for the greater good. We drive on one side of the road, we stop when a traffic light goes red. We can't do whatever the hell we want. We lose liberties. But in return for that, we don't die as much in a traffic accident. I don't think we have got to that stage, at least with this food environment we've been in, of finding that balance. okay? Because some people are libertarians and says, oh, you know, to death, you put this Mars bar out of my hand. And then they're going to be the people who want to keep all the food like the way they sell cigarettes, which is behind a glass cabinet. Both are ridiculous, to my mind. And clearly, it has to sit somewhere in the middle where if I need to go to my children's birthday party or buy my, then we can have a cake, whereas I'm not having cake every day. So the answer is, I don't know the answer, because it's got to be, whatever the answer we find, it's got to be accepted by society, that tension. And it's going to differ from society to society. It's going to differ here to America to China. And that's fine. That's absolutely fine. But we're nowhere near there yet because I think the tenor of the discussion around nutrition and food, certainly in this country, or at least in the higher income countries, I think borders on hysterical. And so we need to remove the hysteria from it in order to come to some kind of societally acceptable position to take, to sort of be able to go to our children's birthday party, but not all die of heart attacks. You know, there's going to be a middle ground.
I really want to get to you, what's your view on the injections, Ozempic and Wegovy and Mounjaro and these, if you have one, and their impact. But before we get there, I wanted to just tackle the issue of highly processed foods and what's going on and the impact that highly processed foods are having on us, regardless of calories, as you say.
So these are the so-called ultra-processed foods. So I guess a couple of things. Is what is the problem with ultra? I'll get to my reservations about the term ultra processed in a second, but just for some definition. So ultra processed foods are different from processed foods. So the vast majority of foods we eat, aside from if you walk into your garden and pluck an apple off a tree, is processed. Cooking is a process. Fermentation is a process. Curing is a process. There's nothing inherently wrong with processed food, is what's kept us alive. Now, ultra processed begins to introduce issues because it is, it's a relatively contemporary process and it's industrialized. So it's industrialized processes that we cannot replicate domestically. We just can't, okay? So what is the problem with ultra-processed foods before I get to the caveats? I think a couple of things. Because of the ultra-processing, it is inherently lower. The food item is inherently lower in protein and or fiber, depending on what we're talking about. Fiber is only found in plants. Because everything is just stripped out. That's problem number one. And so the foods are very calorically available, which means that a protein and fiber slow down the release of calories of food as we actually digest them. And so if you strip something out, then that food is very, very calorically available. All the calories are accessible to us. Problem number one. Problem number two is the ultra processing also strips out flavor. Now, where does flavor come from? Flavor comes from the holy trinity, sugar, salt, fat. Okay, so now if you take out sugar, salt, fat, you have to replace it with sugar, salt, and fat. And so ultra-processed foods tend to be low in protein and fiber and high in salt, sugar, and fat. That's a toxic mixture. So many ultra-processed foods we should eat less of. The issue I have with ultra-processed as an umbrella is it's too broad a church. It covers too many foods. I think there are uncontroversial foods that we should stay away from or at least eat less of. And I think most of us can point them out, turkey Twizzlers or whatever. But they include yogurt, which in of itself is a fermented product, so it's not ultra-processed. But if you have those, I don't know if we can mention brand names, but those square yogurts with a little corner, okay? Now, the yogurt in of itself is fine. But the moment you tip whatever is in that other half of it, be it crunchy, be it a jam, what have you in, suddenly the whole yogurt becomes ultra-processed. Really? I do think there is a difference between an item of food, like a nugget or something like that, that's been sort of molecularly constructed from meat of provenance that is, shall we say, a little bit doubtful, versus yogurt with a bit of jam in it, and the jam is the ultra-processed food. So that is my issue. I think my issue is people, whenever I speak like this, you call me a pragmatist, thank you, most people who are not pragmatists call me in the pocket of big food. I am not in a pocket of big food. I just am a pragmatist. So I think that given that we know what is actually bad for us, we need foods that are of better quality, higher protein, higher fiber. We need to eat less salt, sugar, and fat. All of this is true. Then let's use terms that are more precise about the quality and the type of food, as opposed to something like ultra-processed, which to me includes a lot of foods that, while off-putting to many, because it's definitely not grandma and apple pie, right, because it's an industrial process, doesn't mean it is inherently bad for you.
And you said something in there around things being calorifically available, if I got that right. And you made a passing comment earlier around calories don't count. So I've grown up to think things that are high in calories are bad, things that are low in calories are good. But it sounds like that's maybe not the thinking anymore.
There are some people who still think that, and some people who think I'm anti-physics. I'm not anti-physics. So I think my issue with the calorie is that it gives you only one real piece of information, the amount of food you're eating. So clearly 200 calories of chips is, of course, twice the portion of 100 calories of chips. But so is 200 grams of chips, twice the portion of 100 grams of chips. And no one's trying to compare 200 grams of chips to 200 grams of carrots. And ultimately, that is the point, where calories will tell you the amount of food you're eating, but otherwise nutritionally blind. It doesn't tell you anything about what is in the content. So if you're calorie counting to lose weight, clearly you need to achieve an energy deficit, calorie deficit, to lose weight. It's physics. But there is a big difference between choosing to do that. If say your diet included a 400 calorie lunch, just as an example, where if you ate a steak of 400 calories, I'm being slightly facetious here, but imagine if you have 400 calories of steak or 400 calories of sugar. That's the an extremis. But that's what I'm talking about, where we need to consider calories as one piece of the information, but the quality of food, it's calorie blind.
Question I've got then, Giles, is there an alternative to counting calories? I mean, if I want to lose weight, if I want to watch what I eat, I need to have high fiber, I need to have protein, I need to not worry about calories, but what should I be concerned about?
I do have a solution, or at least what looks like a solution, but no one's listening to me, so it's very difficult to do that solution in isolation. I think the problem is, we have these traffic light signals on our food, the prepackaged foods. Traffic lights in the front, and then a whole reams and reams of nutritional information at the back of the back. Now, what they do is they highlight specific things, including the number of calories, in red, amber, or green. I think we're highlighting the wrong things. So I do think what I think we should be thinking about is the quality of food. And in shorthand, that is highlighting how much protein is in the food. There is also a sweet spot for protein. You don't want to eat too much or too little. You need to highlight the amount of fiber in the food. The more, the better. That needs to be highlighted as well, depending if you're talking about plant foods or about fiber. And I think you probably need to be talking about the amount of free sugars in the food. Now, free sugars are sugars that have been added as opposed to sugars that are stuck in a fruit. Honey, a sugar in of itself, obviously, maple syrup, agave, nectar, whatever it is, they're all free sugars because you add them. Whereas a sugar in a prune or something like that is tied up in the fiber. And maybe the amount of saturated fats. But that is what I would do, actually. I would traffic light those three to four items. And then when you go in and shop, rather than saying that, oh, I need to match my protein, you need to say, well, does this say green, amber, or red for protein? And if I have two items of red for protein because I'm buying a pie or something like that, then I better get some items that are green for protein instead. That is the way that I would reset up the system. I would focus on the nutritional content that really, as a shorthand, reflects the quality of the food, and highlight those instead, so that when you're walking through, you still have the traffic lights, which are a universal signal, without us having to put our glasses and look at font zero, and able to then shop properly. But then we need to change the whole food system, and I don't know when that's going to happen.
I certainly agree with the quality of the food thing, although I suspect we end up in a sort of ability to pay for it conversation. I'll give you one specific example, though. Greek yogurt. Now, I can choose to go on, but which I think is a healthy choice, having a Greek yogurt. Now, I originally was I went down the middle and you could buy 2%, 0%, 2% or 5% Greek yogurt. And I used to go down the middle and go 2%. And that seems a good balance of not too fatty and not too anything else. Then I thought, oh no, I'll be healthy and go for 0%. But then I realized the 0% fat means that a load more sugar has been added into it so that it can become 0% fat. So now I switch back to 5% fat. And I'm trying to be an educated buyer of Greek yogurt. So what should we do about the signage of these foods? And what actually is better for us?
So I think the main issue is we should not be... It's okay, I'm not giving you the easy solution. I'm just telling you what I think. Okay. I think the main issue is we shouldn't be looking at the Greek yogurt specifically. Because once again, what you choose to do, there's a flavor element as well. I think you need to look at your whole diet over a period of time. I think a week seems to be a good type of period of time to go, because you have work days, you have weekends, you have the odd workmate party, and you have your child's birthday party. Okay, so you can imagine that fits within sort of like a week. And over the week, I think we need to hit specific targets about the amount of saturated fats, sugar, protein, and fiber that we want, that we need to hit. And if we can achieve that over the week, then that leaves room for you to have 5% fat Greek yogurt. It leaves you room to have a chocolate bar, but then also it leaves room for you to make sure maybe you have a salad on Thursday night, and maybe you don't have meat on a Tuesday at lunchtime. And so that is, to my mind, it's a far more healthy way of thinking about the food, because now I can enjoy any food I want as long as I don't eat, you know, fatty food or whatever you like that every single meal of my life. So that is probably where I sit. And with what we should be doing with an individual food item.
Giles, I've just had an idea. I think you can make a fortune. You need an app that kind of allows me to manage my fat, protein, fiber, and sugar intake over the week and just keep track of things. I'm sure there's a solution there.
Do you know, I won't mention a name. I am advising, once again, as a consultant, an app that are doing that. Mm. And what they're doing, they collect some information as well. But what they do is they have, with the birth of AI, and I have not seen, they will release the app. They have a paid version. They will release the app actually free to the world. So what you do is you take your phone, you take a picture of whatever the hell it is you're eating. And because of AI... It does. I mean, it's not perfect, but it's as good as it's going to get. Oh my God, it got, I had fried rice. I thought this is going to be complex. Okay. Like fried rice in a Chinese restaurant. I says, okay, everything is mixed together. Let's see how many items it picks up. So I took a picture. It got pretty much every item up. It got the carrot. Oh, that was the chicken. Oh, it was char siu. It got the char siu. It said char siu, you know? And then the only downside is you have to sort of indicate the portion size. So that's probably one of the weakness. But in terms of the percentage of averaged fat, carbs, and proteins that you're getting. And it then does a weekly tally. So you get to the end and you go, do you know what? Last week, I really had way too much fat or way too much this or that.
Would there be a genome test first to determine what my optimum percentage is that I should be managing over the week?
So there will be a number of tests that you can take up front. However, speaking as a geneticist, the tests that claim to be able to find your optimum percentage of your macronutrients, shall we say, are probably jumping ahead of the science at the moment. So I think we know very good averages, but you're absolutely right. It's probably going to differ very subtly between you and me and Simon and Paul. I think that's probably true. But I think the broad strokes are going to be true for all of us as well.
This is probably where we're headed in the 21st century, is it becoming more and more specific as the science becomes more and more clear and that more and more data is accumulated. I mean, I did do a very expensive DNA test, which wasn't about my heritage or my history. It was about the macro components of my DNA. And for all of that money, it told me to eat more broccoli and eat less bread, which was not very helpful. It also told me I was lactose intolerant, which was new for me. I didn't know that, but it seemed very fuzzy just looking at, you know, the results, but I'm sure we're going to get better and better at it.
So I took a similar test. I wrote a piece for one of the major newspapers, actually paid for one of these tests for me to take so I could write a review on it. And I thought I was going to poo-poo the whole damn thing. And much like you, they came with a lot of personalized information that was so personalized it was bland, okay? I also learned I was and I don't want you to judge me looking at the color of my skin. I also learned that I was lactose intolerant. But I am, as it turns out. Therein lies the problem with these tests. There are traits which are genetically predictable. Okay, so for example, lactose intolerance, one gene, one marker, and it can tell, can you digest lactose? Okay, this is the same for alcohol, famously. Okay, this is the same for your ability to metabolize caffeine and a couple of other things. Now, all of these genetic tests incorporate these specific genetic markers. The problem is they mix it together with whether or not you are more or less likely to respond in a Mediterranean diet. There's a big difference between the biochemical ability to chop lactose into glucose and galactose, which is one enzyme, and your ability to handle an entire diet. So the main issue, I think, with these genetic tests is they mix in truly predictable traits with others that are have, you know, minor genetic influence. But if I suddenly realize I am lactose intolerant, everything in this test must be true. That is my problem with these tests, I think.
It was interesting for me because I didn't know I was lactose intolerant. The problem is I like milk and dairy and cheese, but it did have an impact on, well, I clearly should be eating less because it's not doing any good for my body. So small steps. But here's where I want to ask you, what's your opinion on the weight loss injection trend? Everybody's on Wegovy or Mounjaro, which is another one, or Ozempic. Do you have a view on these? I know that some are impacting two of the hormones in the body. Some are impacting one. You know, how do they work, I think, is my first question.
Okay, so Ozempic and Wegovy are actually the same drug. They're called semaglutide, or it's called semaglutide. Ozempic is just happens to be the diabetes version of the drug, and Wegovy is the obesity version of the drug. So it's slightly marketed differently, but chemically it's exactly the same compound. Now, the drug that hits two hormones, so semaglutide hits one hormone, and the hormone is called GLP-1. Mounjaro mimics two different hormones, GLP-1 and GIP. GIP and GLP-1 are both gut hormones. So these are some of the, we know of 20 different gut hormones that go up as we eat and food kind of goes through our gut. And so GIP and GLP-1 are two of these hormones. They do two things. Both GIP and GLP-1 are also called incretin hormones. And why do I call that? If you inject yourself with glucose, like in an IV, for example, like that, your insulin goes up. We understand that biology. When you eat sugar, however, and it passes through the gut wall, there is a 6 to 8-fold enhancement of insulin secretion because as it passes through the gut wall, GIP and GLP-1 goes up. And so GIP and GLP-1's job is to hit the pancreas, which is where insulin is produced, and increase, enhance insulin secretion, which is why these drugs are used as diabetes drugs first.
So just to understand, So they're actually causing the bodily response by causing the insulin to be produced by the body rather than an artificial injection of insulin, for example. The body is responding.
Correct. So your natural hormone is to sort of enhance the insulin secretion for that. The drug hijacks the system in order to prolong the enhancement of insulin because you are diabetic or something and you need more insulin. It's designed to prevent you. Now, this is not true for type 1 diabetes, in which you don't have the cells that produce the insulin have been killed, all right? So the job of the drug within the context of diabetes is to minimize the amount or exclude you from having to need insulin to begin with, to try and make use of your local machinery to produce more insulin. So that's the diabetes side.
And how does it cause us to lose weight then?
So because the other place that it hits is the rear of the brain and the center of the brain, and it makes you feel fuller. Because most of the gut hormones that make you feel fuller, including GIP and GLP-1. But the problem is the native hormones don't stick around for very long. The native hormones only last a couple minutes before they're chopped up. And so the superpower of these drugs are they've sort of been decorated, molecularly decorated, so they stick around the blood for a week or two, which is why they're now once weekly injections. They do exactly the same thing. They enhance insulin secretion, hence diabetes drug. And they sit around the blood for longer and make you feel fuller. I mean, full disclosure, because we're talking about this, you don't know him, so I can talk about him. My son. So my son, I I put him on Mounjaro. So this is the drug which hits GLP-1 at the beginning of the year. I mean, he's in his 20s now. He went to, look, I'm not a skinny person. He's same kind of build as me, but he went to uni and suddenly, whoop, you know, you get the freshers 14. He got the freshers 30. Anyway, so he got quite large. But I put him on the drug and he suddenly said, he talked to me because he loves food like I love food, but I love exercise. Okay, and so that's one little tiny saving grace. He hates exercise and loves food. Toxic mixture. And when what he said is that the moment he took the drug, and I saw it actually, we started on, through some reason, he wanted to start on a New Year's Day. So he started the first injection on January the 1st, 2025. And we were in Wales for just a family vacation and we were having a walk. And, you know, we bring sandwiches for a walk, 8-mile walk, that kind of thing. And he had some small, tiny candy bar in the morning. And then we walked and we did the thing. We got to the end. And I just came to ask him, well, how much did you eat? He goes, no, I didn't eat anything other than the candy bar in the morning, which reflects the good and the bad thing about this drug. The fact that, first of all, the effect was immediate. He injected himself in the morning and he didn't even eat a sandwich for the day. And I can tell you, I make the sandwiches. He would have scoffed half of them. And the second thing, and this is where I'm not on this to sell the drug. I'm not, there are negatives to it. And one of the negatives is that these drugs, they're not negative. It's not a negative. You just need to consider this. These drugs make you feel fuller and therefore you eat less and so you lose weight. They do not improve your diet. And so if my son had not been thinking about it, you could just have a couple of chocolate bars a day and he's going, you know what? I'm full. Woo! And yes, you would lose weight, but at what cost to everything else in your system? So these drugs should be used by the people who need them, but they need to be prescribed with some kind of wraparound care. They need to be prescribed with a dietary intervention. They need to be prescribed with an exercise intervention, actually, in order to maintain your muscle mass. So that's my opinion. They're super powerful because they work pretty much immediately. They're bad because they're super powerful and they work. And they will work whether or not you are a 350-pound man looking to lose 100 pounds, and that's fine, or a 16-year-old girl who's 75 pounds. It doesn't matter what your starting weight is, the drug will work. So you need to be bloody careful about who gets the drug. And you want to aim and you want to make sure the person that gets it needs it. It's ill because of their obesity and needs to take the drug or diabetes or something like that. You can't have people using this, as a lot of people are using it at the moment, as a cosmetic drug. That's what it shouldn't be used as.
And for sure, we're seeing that, right? It's all kinds of ways that people are getting access to these drugs at the moment, which perhaps is, could be another subject of another podcast. Although it is very interesting how it's impacting your behavior. A friend of mine says it feels like the army is marching with you. So it's in some way, back to your appetite triangle, Charles, I guess. It is
that appetite triangle. So where it pulls on the appetite triangle is the fullness side of things. And so you can imagine that it almost shores up the fullness triangle. So you can pull with the reward and the hunger without worrying about the full. So you can eat less, you know, everything and more, because it kind of like almost like puts a bit of foundation up at the fullness side of things. That's where it acts on the triangle.
But does it wear off? So if you've gone through a course of this and you've lost this dramatic amount of weight, are you stuck with the drug forever? Because presumably somewhere along the line, you still need to change your own behaviors if you want to maintain the weight loss.
Yeah, absolutely right. So look, it is a drug. And like all drugs, they only work when you're taking the drug, which means that if you stop, yes, the weight will come back on. So it does appear that many people, although not all, will need to be on some version of this drug for a long time. I think there is an opportunity. You know, I think it was earlier on in this interview where it says, how much of this is learned? What can we learn? Simon, you were the one that was asking me, how much of this is learned and can you change? So can one take the opportunity during the period of time where you're taking it for 2 years or whatever it is you're supposed to be taking it for, where you're losing the weight, where because now you don't have the hunger monster behind you, it means that you can try better exercise regime, because then the problem with exercise is that we exercise and we feel hungry. This is less so because of this drug. And can we practice, learn different habits? Instead of cooking 4 chicken thighs, we cook 2 chicken thighs or whatever it is you actually cook. I think it will be difficult for many people, but I think it will work for some people. However, for most people, I think there's going to need to be some kind of maintenance dose. And all of these drug companies are now exploring. I don't think anyone thinks, within the pharma space, thinks that the weight maintenance stage is going to be the same as the weight loss stage. That requires heavy banging on the door with the drug in order to get you to get there. But the moment you're at maintenance, all the drug companies are testing one of three things. Either reducing the dose, increasing the space in between the injections, or testing oral versions of the drugs. So all of which results in less efficacy, but actually at the maintenance stage is probably more than sufficient. And so let's see where things go as more and more people take it and more people reach the weight maintenance stage of these drugs.
Charles, this has been an amazing conversation. But just some of the things that I've really taken away from this, how we've talked about what really is an eating behavior. And how the way we eat is really sort of informed by our genetics, our own behaviors, and even our neuroscience. To what extent we can already help it, or we're just suffering from our own nurture. I very much like the four behaviors of the cookie story. I'm still trying to think where I sit on there. Somewhere between grabbing and eating the cookie and trying to stoically refuse it, I think. Very much learned a lot about appetite and how appetite is this triangle between how hungry we are, how full we feel, and how nice food actually feels for us. But also what that means in terms of what are some of the levers we need to pull in the food environment and that we're living within that's helping us make smarter choices, particularly around some of the more problematic foods like the ultra-processed foods that are presented to us every day on the supermarket shelves. And then the third thing that is about our own diet. I personally love the book about, you know, why calories don't count, and about the availability of the calories in the food that we're eating, but also what we should actually pay attention to, not just the signage, the low fat, the low sugar, but also the actual quality of the food that we're going to be eating, and then how we can use that to assess our diets. Perhaps I'm going to try this myself on a weekly basis, thinking about, well, have I got a good balance of quality food across the macronutrients throughout the week? And then, of course, we've touched on obesity and the obesity drugs and why these drugs work, how they impact our behaviors, and perhaps one of some of the longer term impacts of these, both for ourselves and perhaps for the pharmaceutical industries as well. Giles, it's been, and I'm sure on behalf of Garrick and I want to thank you very much for a brilliant conversation. If there's one thing you would like to leave our listeners with, what would that be today?
I think for those of you listeners who are larger than someone else for any number of different reasons, then I think the message, which I bang on all the time, is look, there should be a space in the world to understand, in a socially mature society, that obesity, carrying too much fat, is a problem. It's impacting health. Okay, I think we should be able to accept that because it's true, but also not blame the person suffering from the condition. I think, you know, people with obesity are not bad, morally bereft. They're fighting biology. And so I think that's the message we want to take away. And so because they're fighting biology, then we need to make sure that in order to actually fix obesity long term for everyone, then I think we not only need to look at ourselves, we need to look at the entire society and entire community in order to do so. That's my takeaway.
Thank you, Giles. It sounds like there's still quite a lot of work to be done in that space. Thank you so much for joining us. You've been a brilliant guest. You've been listening to the Curious Advantage podcast. We're curious to hear from you. If you think there was something useful or valuable from this conversation, we encourage you to write a review for your podcast on your preferred channel saying why this was so and what you've learned from it. We always appreciate hearing our listeners' thoughts and having a curious conversation. Join today, hashtag Curious Advantage. Curious Advantage book is available on Amazon worldwide. Order your physical, digital or audio copy now to further explore the seven C's of curiosity. Subscribe to the podcast today and follow The Curious Advantage on LinkedIn, Instagram, and keep exploring curiously. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to The Curious Advantage podcast. The Curious Advantage book is now available to purchase on Amazon. Stay tuned for the next episode and keep exploring curiously. This podcast is produced by Jessica Wickham.